This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, what to do to fix Papua New Guinea's crisis in affordable housing.
It's going to run out of the shortage of land, so we have to acquire more customary land because state land is almost finished now.
We'll hear more from PNG's housing minister and others coming up later in the program. And also, hundreds of Samoans caught up in a worldwide cryptocurrency pyramid Ponzi scheme are told they're unlikely to ever get their money back.
There have been a number of victims that have approached the central bank if we can assist in recovering this money. But that is a big challenge for the central bank.
Have more on that story and much more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Graham. First, though, in a landmark case, lawyers have launched court action to challenge Indonesia's 50-year incorporation of Papua into its territory. Lawyers representing about 20 Papuans are seeking a judicial review at the country's highest court, arguing the UN-supervised referendum of 1969, which is known as the Act of Free Choice, and effectively handed Papua to Indonesia. They're arguing that that was illegal because only 1,000 people voted out of a population of 800,000. That referendum led to 5 decades of Indonesian control and often deadly violence with various allegations of human rights abuses. The ABC's Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker has the story.
Even before the UN-backed referendum on Papua took place in 1969, the result was widely known.
The official result will not be announced in Jakarta sometime around the middle of next month. But to the Indonesians, the result is already a foregone conclusion. West Irian will remain with Indonesia.
That was the ABC's own correspondent who covered the vote from what then was Irian Jaya.
President Suharto himself publicly declared some time ago that any other decision would be an act of betrayal.
For decades, Papuans have denounced the referendum as a sham, and Indonesia has crushed any outbreak of sectarian unrest. But now Papuans have taken the fight to the courts. They've come before Indonesia's Constitutional Court in Jakarta to formally challenge the 1969 vote.
It was no act of free choice. Act of no choice. No choice.
Phil Arari was a student in Jakarta when the referendum was held. He wanted to vote but says he was told by Papuan leaders he couldn't. Only 1,025 Papuans were handpicked to take part. All of them voted to remain part of Indonesia.
They were heavily intimidated, telling them that they have to state that you remain a part of Indonesia.
And did they really want that?
Of course not.
Lawyers for several Papuans want the court to acknowledge the referendum was illegal and led to a violation of their rights. Their spokesman Agus Sumule says at the very least they want a truth commission set up to expose the wrongs of the past.
So from a point of view, it is not a threat to anybody. It's not a threat to the Republic. It is actually will make Indonesia stronger if they will be willing to go into that direction.
Phil Arari supports a second genuine referendum.
That the people should give in the personal right to vote for their political rights in Papua.
Indonesia has dismissed the demand, saying the Papua issue is finished and can't be discussed anymore. And whatever the court's judgment, it's unlikely to bring any real change on the ground. More than 1 million Indonesians have migrated to Papua since 1969. Today, they outnumber the indigenous population in many areas and dominate the economy, police and the military.
The military of Indonesia who control everything until today. Today you know about the military business. They control illegal logging, illegal fishing, illegal mining, controlled by the military and the police.
The case could run for months.
Sam Barker reporting there from Jakarta in Indonesia. Papua New Guinea is facing a crisis in affordable housing in its major cities and towns, but the government is confident that it's edging closer to a solution. A national housing policy is expected to go to the country's cabinet, that's the National Executive Council, this week, with a view to passing legislation by the middle of the year. The government says the key to addressing these sky-high prices will be dealing with the complex and difficult issue of customary land reform. Bill Bainbridge has more.
PNG's Housing Minister John Cowper says the country's housing policy has not been updated in 24 years, despite PNG having some of the most expensive real estate in the world.
That rent that we apply to the public servants around 200 kinara a week, so 800 kinara a month. But the same duplex that the company sleeps is around 2,000 a month. So there's a big gap there.
Now, he says after 18 months' work, a new policy is 90% complete.
The policy that we can provide more social housing for our public servants and the citizens of our country.
Eugene Ezebillo from the National Research Institute says in cities and towns, rent is typically far higher than household income.
The amount they pay in rent per month, it's about 20 to 30% higher than their income. And the worst hit is the East towns. It's about 200% above the household income. So it's not affordable at all.
But despite that, in Port Moresby, an emerging middle class is very gradually moving into home ownership. General Manager of Housebuild Real Estate, Tom Snelling, says their most recent real estate survey showed some growth in home ownership, with 16% of people saying they own their own home, up from 10% a few years ago.
More people seem to be able to afford housing than before. There's a growing sort of middle market bracket.
All agree the key factor limiting housing affordability in places like Port Moresby is the fact 90% of the land is held as customary title. John Cowper says the government is working on measures to convert that customary title into state lease titles, which he says will free up banks to make loans against the properties and unlock huge tracts of land in PNG.
Well, we need more than 100,000 houses, but it's going to run out with shortage of land. So we have to acquire more customary land because state land is it's almost finished now. So as a government initiative, we must acquire state land in order to provide houses.
He says earlier this month, the government compulsorily acquired 50 hectares of customary land in Port Moresby with the agreement of the landowner. And he says the new housing policy will make completing similar transactions easier in the future and help put more Papua New Guineans into a property they can afford.
I think that's the only way forward. Compulsory acquired with consultation with the landowner so that we can outright purchase or lease it so that we can provide more affordable houses, social housing for all.
It is the PNG Housing Minister John Cowper, the reporter Bill Bainbridge. Well, an Asia-Pacific security expert says moves by Russia to tighten its relationship with PNG shows a possible desire to position itself as the middle ground between the expansion of China and the unpredictability of Donald Trump's United States. Last week, Russia's Economic Development Ministry declared it was setting a new direction for bilateral relations with PNG in humanitarian, cultural and also economic spheres, following on from talks at last year's APEC Leaders Summit in Port Moresby. Now, it comes 43 years after Russia and PNG first established their diplomatic ties. Dr. Alexei Muravyov is the Associate Professor of National Security and Strategic Studies at Perth's Curtin University. He spoke with Pacific Beat's Nick Fogarty and started off by telling him what the commitment to a closer relationship might mean for Russia, for PNG, and also for the wider Pacific region.
The level of economic trade is not really significant, but nonetheless, PNG is a member of the international community. It is placed strategically in terms of its geography in the southern sector of the Pacific. So having a friendly nation with convenient ports and harbors, a nation that can support Russia or at least not object to Russia's actions as a member of the United Nations, a nation that perhaps can benefit from certain levels of bilateral cooperation with Russia, including in the military sphere, is something that is potentially lucrative for both the Russians as well as Papua New Guineans. For them, having a relationship with yet another great power besides China, and despite the deepening close ties with Australia, provides them with a degree of geopolitical maneuvering. And I think this is something we need to certainly consider.
The foreign minister mentioned also PNG's rich natural resources. Do you think it would be likely that Russian companies would be encouraged to get more involved in Papua New Guinea's very large, very lucrative oil and gas projects?
There is no doubt that the Russians have a long-term interest in investing in PNG economy, also in terms of exploration and extraction of mineral resources. Russian primes do consider PNG as an area of potential exploration and exploitation, but it would very much depend on the extent of political and broader strategic ties between Port Moresby and Moscow. If the dialogue between Papua New Guinea and Russia would intensify and would only strengthen, I think you would actually see some serious investment that the Russians would start making into PNG economy, particularly its resources sector. At the end of the day, Russia considers the Asia-Pacific as an area of its growing strategic interest. The Russians are here for the long haul, and whilst they're not investing and they're not committing the same level of resources as the Chinese to the area, wherever they go in terms of targeting certain countries and establishing ties, they're not looking for quick fix solutions. They're looking at something they could benefit from for many years to come.
That is Dr. Alexey Muravyov. He's from Curtin University, speaking there with Nick Fogarty.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, Solomon Islands-based academic believes last week's rioting in the capital, Honiara, following the election of the Prime Minister, was caused by inequality and fuelled by corruption. Dr. Anouk Ride says many young people in the country feel marginalised, and so they took to the streets to vent their anger. Now that the situation has settled, Dr. Ride says Solomon Islands needs to look at long-term measures to prevent such unrest in the future. As Evan Wasuka reports.
For Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare, the cause of last week's rioting is clear.
Really unfortunate situation fueled by the opposition group using, of course, the illiterates and basically criminal elements in town to support their calls and that. So it's really, 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 really unfortunate. Basically, there was total disregard and an understanding of the process of democracy in this country.
But Dr. Anouk Ride has another view. She's a researcher on interpersonal violence and social inclusion and says the protests were caused by a number of key factors.
These riots are a consequence of inequality. And inequality is sort of manifested in several different things, caused firstly by corruption here in the migration and logging system, so that we've had large numbers of largely uncontrolled urban developments, uncontrolled developments in the provinces that have advantaged some political powerful people, advantaged some migrants and foreigners, but have brought very little economic benefits to the vast majority of local Solomon Islanders.
Young people make up the bulk of Solomon Island's population, but Dr. Ride says they feel marginalised.
For young men in particular, they have very low chances of finding a job. They tend to have very little faith in existing institutions, like government sort of listening to them, their concerns.
She says there's been frustration by young men about not having influence over the decision taking place behind closed doors for the election of the Prime Minister. And they took to the streets to show their frustration by targeting Asian businesses.
The symbolism is that both foreigners and people in political power have locked the rest of society out from the decision-making, from the benefits of development. And so Asians are always targeted as the symbol of this broader problem, which is really more of an inequality problem.
There was a similar incident back in 2006 when the election of Snyder Rini as Prime Minister sparked rioting and looting on a much larger scale than which was seen last week. Dr. Ride says the country needs to have a discussion about why riots keep happening and leaders need to deal with corruption and inequality.
We need to invest in youth development. The investment in finding young people productive jobs and livelihoods is ridiculously small, like half the discretionary funding for one member of parliament per year is like the total national budget for youth development And this symbolises the inequality that we have in systems.
Dr. Wright said there also needs to be further effort made in conflict resolution.
So yes, we have the police, and they're doing a pretty good job in controlling the situation here in Honiara. But the ideal would be, where are the people who are going to step in before the conflict escalates out of hand and talk to people and try and broker solutions from both sides and try and calm things down before they reach violence?
It's Dr. Anouk Ride, a researcher on interpersonal violence and social inclusion in Solomon Islands. The reporter there, Evan Wasuka. Well, hundreds of victims of a cryptocurrency scam in Samoa have been told that it's unlikely they'll ever get their money back. OneCoin has been promoted worldwide, with US authorities estimating that globally victims have invested billions of dollars into the scheme. In Samoa, it was promoted by widely trusted church ministers before it was banned from operating by the country's central bank mid last year. It's since been labelled a high-risk pyramid Ponzi scheme and is the subject of ongoing police investigations, various ones right around the world, with US authorities arresting OneCoin's founder back in March. Now, the Central Bank of Samoa's acting governor, Gilbert Wongsin, says if it was a fresh intelligence report by New Zealand police that renewed their concerns and prompted them to issue a new warning. He spoke with Pacific Beat's Susie Rains.
The report from the New Zealand police highlighted a number of financial issues in terms of money leaving the country and coming into the country, and also reveals some of the financial transactions. The key of the report reflects some of the activities that are considered high risk to the point of illegal activity happening. The movement of the money from Samoa to New Zealand to Australia, this is the whole gist of the report.
It's estimated that around 3.5 million New Zealand dollars have been transferred out of New Zealand as part of the OneCoin scheme. Where exactly did that money come from?
That's correct. It's one of the areas that requires further investigation.
Church ministers were used to promote this cryptocurrency. They're trusted and widely respected there in Samoa. Has the involvement of these ministers been investigated?
Yes, the central bank is looking closely into this particular area, and it's currently under observation and investigation with the central bank working together with other law enforcement agents.
Do you believe that the individuals at these churches knew that they were involved in a scam?
That is an important area that the central bank is working on in promoting awareness and getting that message out there. And in particular for the public who are lured in to invest their money without proper information to understand the risks of their investment.
Is it clear yet just how widespread this scam actually is? Are you able to say how many people have been duped and how much has been lost?
At the tune of about hundreds of people. And if you refer to the report by the New Zealand police, to a magnitude of about over 5 to 7 million tala. And this is the figure that we're still working to get all the information.
What do you say to those who've invested? Will they ever see their money again?
That is the concern why we have going out to promote education. There have been a number of victims that have approached the central bank if we can assist in recovering this money. But that is a big challenge for the central bank, and we try to reach out to our counterparts overseas without any success.
Do you believe that these victims should give up on getting their money back?
The victims' money is their money, but at the same time, from a bigger picture, is financial stability of the system is important because it does have an impact on foreign reserves.
Is it possible these people may never get their money back?
It is possible. There's a great possibility of that, and that is something that we would like to protect happening going forward.
It's believed that a number of Samoan individuals are implicated in this scheme. What can you say about who's behind all of this, and will they be brought to justice?
Well, all this is still under investigation. At this point, it's one of those important questions that we need to get the information and share some of the findings at the same time, promoting awareness and understanding of people, of the risks that they get into. But certainly, at some stage, certain actions could be taken by the central bank.
There's Gilbert Wong-Sin. He's the Central Bank of Samoa's acting governor, speaking there with Susie Rains. Finally this morning, a Fijian man who says he was treated like slave labour when he first arrived in Australia to work as a fruit picker some two decades ago is now contesting this month's federal election after he became an Australian citizen. Moe Taranga is running as an independent in a regional seat in the state of Queensland. It's traditionally been a conservative electorate, but he says a lot of people share his views on issues like climate change, as Liam Fox reports.
Moe Taranga has not taken the decision to run for federal parliament lightly.
Because I knew coming into it what I had to give up. I had to give up my Fijian citizenship to be able to run or to be able to be a candidate into the federal parliament. And that's how serious I've taken this issue and in regards to the voices of the Pacific that hasn't been heard, you know, and also hoping to represent our local indigenous community here as well into their needs and how they want to sustain their culture, their language.
He's running as an independent candidate for the regional Queensland seat of Hinkler, which takes in the coastal towns of Bundaberg and Hervey Bay, about 3 hours' drive north of Brisbane. He's lived in Bundaberg for 20 years after initially arriving in Australia as a 17-year-old to work as a fruit picker on farms around Albury-Wodonga in Victoria.
It's a hell of a lot warmer than the Wodonga winters and the Albury winters, you know, and the kids loved it. And the beaches, the rivers, and, you know, everything that I can grow in Fiji, I can grow here. So that was a major plus. And it's a beautiful place, mate. It's paradise.
He loves his adopted home now, but his introduction to life in Australia was not a happy one. Mr. Taranga found himself in debt slavery after the cousin who invited him over to work took his passport, gave it to a migration agent, and told him he had to repay the costs of his travel and visa. Not only that, after working long days picking grapes for effectively no pay for 2 years, he found out his cousin had not been sending any money back to his mother in Fiji. Luckily, a friendly farmer helped get his passport back and offered him another job. In recent years, Mr. Taranga has shared his story as part of the push to get Australia to adopt laws to combat slavery and human trafficking, which will come into force next year.
We live in an area which, you know, we still got the history of the Kanakas. Of the people that are black-bearer to Australia, especially in this region. So that's still in the back of people's minds, and, you know, and it's very much a taboo subject at the moment in Queensland still.
For most of its history, the seat of Hinkler has been held by the National Party and its successor, the Liberal National Party, or LNP, which is closely aligned to the interests of the agriculture and resource industries. It's known for its scepticism of human-induced climate change and strong support for the coal industry. But like many Pacific Islanders, Mr. Taranga is deeply concerned about the impact of climate change and wants to see Australia transfer to renewable sources of energy. And despite the LNP's past hold on the seat, he believes many locals share his views.
There's a cry out for, especially from the young voices at the moment, to have thoughts around climate change. And they, you know, they want to see green energy, they want to see renewable energy, they want to see a sustainable future. But we also need to have a look at the changes of industry in regards to bringing in a green energy and how that will replace our mining industries and our slowly phasing that out if we can do.
He says his Fijian heritage is an asset on the campaign trail.
I think the Pacificness, you know, the smiles, the chilled vibe, but also putting people at ease in regards to the caring side. You know, I do really care for this community. Because I want the community to grow, and I want my nephews and my nieces and their kids to live here and way into the future rather than keep shifting to the cities.
Hinkler does not have a large Pacific Islander community like electorates in other places like Western Sydney and Brisbane South. But Mr. Taranga says it's growing.
You know, when you have a Tuvalu community group here, you know you've grown a bit. You know, that's such a small island, and you know, they've concentrated here. The Samoans are always here. The Tongans are getting bigger, so is the Fijians.
Can you count on the other Pacific Islanders' votes? Have they pledged their support for you?
Well, all I've got to do is dangle a bag of cover in front of them. I think they'll be coming.
is Moe Taranga. He's running as an independent in the regional seat in Queensland in the upcoming election here in Australia. Australians will be going to the polls on May the 18th. The reporter there was Liam Fox. That's all for Pacific Beat this morning. Don't forget, though, our stories are online on our website, and also most of our stories also make it to our Facebook page. Just find and like the ABC Radio Australia page. The stories will show up in your feed. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for your company. Have a great day.